Do you seek the freedom to pursue greater meaning and purpose in your life? Is there something that you're passionate about that you'd like to support by giving time, talent, or money? Do you seek a level of financial freedom to live an ideal life as you uniquely define it? Welcome to the Money and Meaning Show with Jeff Bernier, a show dedicated to helping you gain the confidence and freedom to lead a life of personal significance and help you get your actions and resources in alignment with what matters most.
Well, hello and welcome to the Money and Meaning Show. I'm so pleased that you decided to spend a few minutes with me today. I am Jeff Bernier. I am your monthly guide and host as we have conversations around money and meaning. And we, as you well know, on this show, we try to put together some interesting guests to help us talk about things related to meaning and purpose and how do we find joy in our lives and how do we get all the clutter out so we can go do the things that matter to us. And importantly, how do we create the financial margin to have the means to go do it? And so we also talk a lot about wealth management topics to help you create the clarity and confidence, but also the means so that you can go out and do the things that you feel called to do. So happy to have you today for our conversation. And, you know, are you ever in that place where you just feel like you're, quote, in the zone? You know, have you ever been engaged in an activity where time just flew by, you know, where you had more energy when you were finished with the activity than you did when you started, and you never get bored or you never get tired of learning and growing while you're doing those types of activities? Well, if you have, and I'm sure you have, you're in what some people call a state of flow. And as we move into the second half of our lives, wouldn't it be great if we could spend more of our time in that state of flow, in that state or in that zone? Well, I'm so happy today to have a guest who is an expert on the intersection of wealth and psychology, and in particular, this whole concept of how do we get into that state? How do we get into that flow state? So please join me in welcoming my friend and guest today, Dr. Jordan Hutchison. Jordan, thanks for being here today. I want to give just a very quick introduction. So Dr. Jordan Hutchison is the Vice President of Technology at RFG Advisory and is an expert in this whole idea around flow theory. But he has broader knowledge as well on general financial planning, but also the intersection of financial planning and psychology. He is actually a professor at the Kaplan College for Financial Planning in the areas of behavioral finance. He has multiple industry certifications, a master's in financial planning, importantly, a doctorate in business administration, but specifically expertise and study in behavioral sciences and positive psychology. So, Jordan, I would spend the whole day reading your bio, but welcome and thanks for joining me.
I don't know who that guy is, but he sounds fairly smart. But
he does sound really smart. And what's surprising, he's also a pretty engaging and a fun guy to hang out with. So thanks for being here.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I'm very happy to. I always enjoy our conversation, so I look forward to chatting today.
Yeah, likewise. And you know, as is the normal practice when I do these podcasts, I just like the audience to get to know you personally a little bit. So what I'd love to do is just get you to spend a couple minutes just talking about your family and yourself.
Yeah, so I'll start with the family. I am married. I've been married for almost creeping up on a decade, and actually met my wife here in Atlanta, Georgia. She is it's quite unique. She's from born and raised New York City. And I am born and raised in North Alabama. So I make the joke that our first few months was just trying to figure out how to speak to each other. Who was saying what with, you know, it's two very different dialects, cultures, backgrounds. And so it was great. We both learned a lot about the world just because we had two totally different backgrounds. But we did find one thing that we did have the same values. So that's where we met. But I have two kids. I have a five-year-old boy named Roman and a two-year-old girl named Sabina. So they usually keep me pretty busy. The five-year-old is starting baseball these days. So that is where you'll find me right now on the weekends. And usually after work, that's where a lot of my time has been committed.
Yeah, very cool. Well, you know, we met each other at Future Proof, actually, the conference out in California a couple of years ago.
Right.
And I've had a couple of, you know, coffee visits from time to time after that. And we share a passion for this whole idea around behavioral finance and how to have financial contentment and wellness. And obviously you're an expert in this area, but you have a varied career path as well as a varied education path. Would you mind just sharing that a little bit? Kind of share your path and how you got interested in these areas on the intersection of psychology and money?
Yeah, I think that it goes back actually quite a ways on my career, because I grew up with a mother that was a counselor. And it's funny, she eventually, you know, she was a licensed counselor. And then she was also started working for a high school as a guidance counselor for seniors going to college. And statistically, they say, don't get a degree in psychology or history, because it's the hardest job to find or hardest major to find a job after college. Well, of course, my brother and I did not listen to her. I got an undergrad in psychology. My brother got an undergrad in history. So I think we both turned out all right. So it does work out. But I really think that going through my career, I did undergrad in psychology. I played sports. I actually played basketball in college and then went to graduate school. And the reason I went to graduate school was actually because I didn't get Thanksgiving. I barely got a few days for Christmas because of playing sports. But I vividly remember a conversation with my father going, so there's no more basketball after this year. What are you going to do? And I had never thought about that. And so I, like very many people, fell into financial planning by looking at different programs, interviewing at different master's programs, because I was like, all right, well, maybe I could find myself a couple extra years by going and getting a master's and learning the program. Well, I found the financial planning department at University of Alabama. Don't know if that's going to be a bad statement here, but since we're both based in Georgia, but had a great program, great time, great professors. I love the two women that ran the program very much. And they really directed me and found the love for the balance of how actually psychology was a great background for understanding the quantitative side of financial planning they could teach. The qualitative side, the psychology piece, was just as important, and if not more. And so that's really where it started. And I started to really expand. I actually started as an advisor, spent some time building a practice, got to really intimately know that, worked for a couple large firms, and then actually met another behavioral science person and said, you know, I'm considering leaving the business. I think that I just want to study this because it's so interesting. The more I meet with clients, I find out that I'm talking to them about their family, their life, so many things that are bigger to them than the income that they made, and really how to use that money as a tool instead of really getting into the weeds of the plan. I enjoyed that conversation of, well, what do you want to do with life? Where do you want to go? How do you want to use this money? Are you saving for someone, your grandkid, that's important to you, or whatever the topic is? And so that's really where I started to pursue it, started to consider, and actually transitioned out of being a day-to-day advisor to start managing and coaching advisors. And that's where I started going back to graduate school, did my doctorate, worked for a couple large firms and specializing in that area. And then again, probably not by the best of choice, where most people will stay with the company for 20 years, I got another feeling where I was like, how do I influence our industry on a bigger scale through technology with behavioral science?
Right.
And so that's where I actually completely left the day-to-day financial services and went into what we call fintech, financial technology, and started building a product of how can I build this to be beneficial to advisors so that they have something useful to work with their clients on these topics around money. And so it was kind of all over the place. And I've talked to a few people on my team, and when I'm hiring people too, I'm very big on hiring for character and bringing people in that even aren't in our industry, because I was lucky to have great leaders like that that would give me a shot when I had no technology background in my career or at one point. So my career kind of moved around of my interest, and I was very blessed to always have somebody to learn from, and got to work with some of the best in our industry, Michael Kitsis, and some of these people that are very much visionaries in financial planning. So I've been all over the scope, but had a great time doing it. And now with RFG, I get to influence on both sides now.
Yeah. Yeah. So you're both coaching advisors and teaching and, being a leader to advisors to help them do the behavioral side better, more effectively, but you're also helping the firm, build the infrastructure and the technology and the tools to deliver it at scale, I guess, to give it to right. more clients and in an efficient way. So that's pretty cool. So, I have some guesses about the things that matter to you just from hearing your story about your family and sports and obviously finance and behavioral psychology. But, this show is all about helping people figure out what matters, kind of what their why is, as Simon Sinek used to say in his famous book and podcast or YouTube or TED Talk, rather. I'll get right in a moment. So what is your why? What gets you buzzed? What really gets you excited about life and what you're doing?
It's always interesting. The question around purpose, it's so hard unless you've done the work to think it through or to talk through it with somebody. And it's interesting how a lot of financial advisors like yourself are the ones that get to open that door for people, because I think a lot of people live a life that they kind of just went through the motions, that they never sat and reflected. And, there's tons of research where people have studied people at the end of their life or, when they're on their deathbed and they're like, well, what are your biggest regrets? And it's like, it's never, I should have worked more, or I should have saved more money on this thing. It's like, I should have done the things that I wanted to do, or spent time with the people that were most purposeful to me. So for me, I've spent a lot of time thinking about this, and I almost have created a mantra or a vision kind of statement to myself that does kind of tie in, because flow is very purposeful to me, and we'll talk more about that here soon. But I've always used this phrase and I say it to every employee that I hire, is be curious, be grateful, and find flow. And all three of those, and I've had a friend one time say that should be on a t-shirt somewhere, but so maybe I should do that one day. But the way that I look at that is being curious is really in anything. I'm curious, I'm seeking knowledge. I always want to learn more, look at other people's perspective. I feel like there's just so much in the world. If I could get paid to be a student of the world or just take courses and designations, I probably would. But even though my wife is a very successful executive in the tech world, she would probably kill me if I thought that was my full-time job. So yeah. I got a taste of that in academia, and she was like, you had your time. So no more education for a little while. Cause I was like, I'd love to go to law school, but we got two little ones to raise. And then the be grateful really kind of falls around like family. And also it's like a mantra for me daily too, because there's so many things that I've been lucky and been blessed with that I've got to think through those and make sure that I'm, some people have a gratitude exercise or a gratitude journal. If it's a task or a burden, then you're not going to really get the benefit of it. But I always, when I'm having a bad day or if something's difficult, that's another thing that I've always looked at. So it's kind of a purpose to me, is those two. And then the last one around our topic today is find flow. It's really about just like finding the strengths and the things that I'm good at, and how can I give back or contribute, and also find happiness, because I really, one of the many things that gives me flow, which we'll talk more about, is my kids. I love just hanging out and being dad. That's like, was one of my things I always wanted to do, partially because I had a great rapport and relationship with my parents. I always wanted to be a father. And so that's one of the many things outside of sports and activities and things. But that's kind of my purpose statement, or because I've done a lot of time thinking about this, to be someone that had to research around some of these topics. Right. It's definitely, and I highly recommend people to watch that TED Talk from Simon Sinek, because it's a great quick TED Talk that makes you start to really think like, okay, there has to be something bigger in life that I'm tied to. Of course there's, undertones of my religion and faith and stuff like that, but that's kind of the mantra that I tell to myself every day.
Yeah. I love it. So be curious, be grateful, and find flow. And, I think, the comment you said about a lot of people don't go to the woods or take the space to actually bring this into the front of their consciousness is so critical, because I know there was a book out a few years ago, and he was using the movie about the big storm where the guy's on the boat.
The perfect storm. Yeah.
And one of the lines in the book was the Coast Guard people said, you know, one of the comments they ask is, you know, are they, you know, when they're trying to figure out, are they conscious or not? You know, so they're alert and conscious times zero, essentially, when they're unconscious. Right. And he kind of, you know, John Eldridge put this in a book that he wrote, and he talked about most of us just kind of walk through life unconscious because we're busy and we've got life and we've got, you know, influences in our life, and we just don't take the time. And so you and I are pretty fortunate. We're in an industry where we're allowed to help people take this time. I mean, how grateful should we be about that? That we get to be in a profession where we actually get to talk to people and allow them to take the time.
Right.
And so that's cool. But I love those. Be curious, be grateful, and find the flow. I think there's a lot of meat there. And I know there's a lot of subparts to all of that, in terms of certainly all three, but certainly on the flow that we'll get to. So what, you know, you've studied the happiness literature. You know, when we met, we were, you know, you were helping with a program that helped us dig into more of the psychology around advising our clients. And one of the big parts of it was a lot of the happiness literature. What does the happiness literature or the research say about purpose for people in retirement? And I don't even like the word retirement. I'm kind of like, other people in our industry, you know, retirement's what they do with old equipment when it's no longer useful, they put it out in the desert, you know?
Right.
But when we move into the second act, we change context and we move into second parts of our lives, or the third act or the fourth act. What does the happiness literature say about the importance of having a purpose?
I love that you call it the second act instead of, cause there's a guy that's actually based in the UK that was a former client of mine and still a close friend, who I'll see here in a couple of weeks, cause we share the love for Boston Celtics basketball.
Okay.
But, he used to say, like, retirement is a completely made up thing that we created, you know, as humans. And so I love that you call it the second act, because it is, things definitely change, and you do need to have a conversation about that second act, or do some reflection either by yourself, or I recommend with somebody like a financial advisor, or if it's, you know, somebody that works in that space that can be that sounding board or guide for you, because all these things, our industry is so interdisciplinary where, yeah, we have, you know, estate planning and life insurance and income planning, distribution, all that is tied into, there's emotions that fill under all of that, how you change it. And that second act, to me, it's a huge thing of your identity changing. And the way that I, and more like common, because in academic research, we call it your identity. But in the way I would say it is your roles, like your roles in life. So like sometimes, you know, when you are an empty nester, your role now has changed where you are no longer, I mean, they might be leaving the house to go to college or leaving the house to have their own apartment and work, but now your role as a parent has changed. Or if, you know, when you retire, you're no longer, the joke I've always made to try to bring light to the situation is you go from executive or VP or whatever your title is to just the third person in line at Starbucks. And it kind of feels, you know, bad, because you're like, all right, well, all of my importance to this company or my job and my relationships at work, they've changed. And so it's really hard, and you need to think through how that transition will happen. And if you do it just so abruptly and quickly, it could be detrimental to, you'll want to spend more money on things that are probably not purposeful to you. You might buy things that you don't really need to because you're just searching. And another example I'll use is when athletes, big time, you know, NFL or pro athletes, NFL came to my mind because I was thinking about like Tom Brady retiring or Brett Favre or any of these great quarterbacks. You find out like they just can't give it up, or they'll end up getting themselves in trouble or getting hurt because they're pushing themselves to play well into their 40s when they should have retired 5 years ago, because it's not a money thing anymore to them.
Right.
And it's because they're losing their identity as this superstar. And so that's another transition. So these things happen all through life. Our identities are always constantly changing. And so with that act two into retirement, I think that that is, or call it retirement, into the second, that second half, you really need to talk through it. And for your happiness, you've got to diversify what gives you that engagement in life. What are your hobbies? And you've got to start talking about it sooner than later, because then you can start to fill out, all right, well, these are things that I've always had interest in, but now that, you know, I'm looking down, you know, see that light at the end of the tunnel in 2 years, I will have the capacity to really dig in and work more with my church or volunteer, or maybe I'm an attorney and I'm retiring and I can do more pro bono work. You know, there's so many things. We all have our gifts and strengths that we can contribute.
Yeah. Yeah. So the happiness literature basically says that there is a high correlation between having that purpose or having that thing to go to, in terms of, you know, mental well-being, I guess, or happiness.
Is that correct?
Is that fair? Yeah. Yeah.
Correct.
Yeah. And one of the things you brought up, I think, is one of the challenges, but I wanted to ask you about that. And you sort of led into it, you know, so the challenges moving into that phase, what are the main challenges psychologically for the executive who's now the third person at Starbucks as opposed to, you know, the CEO or the chief executive or the vice president of marketing? So what are some of their challenges in that? It's the identity, obviously, is part of it. What are some of the others that they have to sort of grapple with?
Yeah. So with that identity shift, one of the biggest things is, you know, you might have gotten what we, you know, we'll talk to it more, but like that flow and engagement from your career. So you've got that losing track of time, that positive emotion from it, that fulfillment. And then also one of the big things that's really important too is your relationships. You can't, you know, hopefully you've got a community in some other aspect that you can have that benefit of relationships outside of, you know, a partner and significant other, but like a community. And a lot of people get that value because they really like the people they work with. And having those relationships one day and then dropping them off, that becomes pretty difficult. And so right. I think that there's some really good research out of the MIT Age Lab where they talk about almost like asset allocation of your portfolio, asset allocation of your friendships. And, you know, if you have neighbors that are younger families and, you know, and I live in the suburb of Atlanta where my neighborhood is full of kids, but at the same time, it's full of retired people as well. You've got to diversify those relationships because that gives you energy. It also, you know, one of the really sad things about that second half of life is that if you're the one living and healthy, you start to see some of your friends and family die.
Right.
And it's really sad, but if you start to diversify your friendship, it'll give you more energy, it'll keep you more youthful, but it'll also open you up to the world, because in that second phase, we start to get a little more passive in trying new things. I can't remember the exact research because I always tease my actual parents who are in their coming up on their early 80s, and they've never tried sushi. And so there's like a real academic paper out there that says something, I can't remember the exact date, but it's like, if you haven't tried sushi by the age of, it's something like 30, the odds of you ever eating it is like single digits, like you'll never try it. And so it's one of those things that your second phase of life, we tend to just be more comfortable and we're less likely to try new things. And that's actually one of the really interesting new areas of research on flow and the neuroscience side of it, is that it actually, if you're finding flow in your older second half of your life, it actually combats cognitive decline, which is such a cool thing that, like, wow, we're starting to see that this could actually help that decline of our brain. And just if we're having these engagement and these different activities. So,
yeah. Yeah. Well, let's talk about flow for a minute. So tell me about your dissertation, first of all, because I know when you got your PhD, I think you went deep on this with your dissertation and probably sent you totally different directions in your career because of that. But tell me, and I think the dissertation had something to do with flow, engagement at work, and financial planning. So tell me about what it was. What did you find in your research? And what was it about?
Right. Yeah. And so my chair, who was a very brilliant man, Dr. Shoemaker is his name. And I think anyone that's gone through the journey of doing a dissertation, you find out real quick that a completed dissertation is a good one. And because you get in there and
you get finished. Yeah.
Because it takes years. And, you know, there's so many things that you have to get. You get humbled because you learn what is really good writing, what's good research, just all these things that it's a journey. I learned more about just like grammar and writing and things like that than I think I ever could have in the other half of my life of education, because you get redlined, you know, obviously redlined on a computer now instead of on a paper, but you just get to that. You had to be better. You got to get better. And so my research was actually, you know, and you try to add a fancy title to it. So I called it Finding Wolf in the Workplace, you know, Flow and Engagement and Financial Planners. And so actually flow backwards is wolf. So, you try to put a fancy title to add some color to some 100+ pages of writing, very academic. And I'm a very casual person. So it's funny when I write academically, I'm like, who wrote that? And it's... It's funny that you can switch it up, but my research really focused on, is flow a predictor of certain outcomes and actually engagement? So a lot of times companies talk about employee engagement or work engagement, job engagement, however you want to phrase it. And so sometimes people will see them closely related with the concept of flow. And so I did research on both of those states to basically validate, hey, these are very different in what they do and where you find them. And then also, is flow predicting it? And I looked at, of course, you've got to make it even more complex, like any true academic writing. I added other variables of age. So how did the impact of younger people versus older people in our industry, how did years of experience? So how did years of experience totally, but also years of experience specifically in financial planning? Because uniquely, our industry, almost half of the financial advisors in our space are career changers. So they started their career as a financial advisor almost at 40. So thinking about the second act, there's so many people that decided that, you know what, I'm really interested in this. Let's do a full 180 career shift. So that's what I looked at. And then I studied, what are those outcomes of having that flow experience? And so one of my favorite was that you get a spillover effect. And sometimes I toy with a phrase like that flow glow, you know, you gotta be catchy. But that flow glow, and that's the spillover, that when you have these flow experiences at work, you have a spillover of energy and vigor in your life. And for me, as a person who had two kids, very grateful for my amazing wife, for going through a doctoral program, having two kids, that you get more energy in your life post-work. And I thought that was just like mind-blowing to me, but that's one of the big things I found out in my research, that you get this spillover of energy, which was just so foundational for somebody that was running on minimal sleep, is trying to, you know, shuffle kids around, things like that, to school and to sports. So for me, that was one of the big things that I found. There was a few other, but that was one of my like foundational that kind of broke the glass.
Yeah. So if you have more experience of flow states in your work or in your day job,
correct.
You tend to have more attention, a presence, engagement with your family when you're not at work. Is that kind of what I'm hearing?
Correct. And it's one of the ways, there's a great book you've read it too, The Atomic Habits by James Clear. Yeah. And one of his examples is he talks about, you got four eyes on the stove. You only can burn three. And I try not to use the word like biohack or, you know, let me find a way around it. But it was like, well, if I find a job or a purpose or a career that I'm really engaged in, I can have all four. And I can find that spillover where I'm going to have energy, because you want to save some energy for your family at the end of the day. You don't want to be irritable and, you know, difficult to be around. I think we all know where that ends up. And so it was really interesting to me to find that piece, and you're 100% right.
Yeah, let's define flow a little bit. We've talked about it like everybody knows what it is, because I think we know what it is when we feel it. Mm-hmm. We don't know what to name it, but I think we, you know, when we feel it, we know what that is. But how would you define flow as you're using it in your dissertation and our conversation today?
Yeah, so the way that I actually defined it in my dissertation was, flow is a state of deep absorption in an activity or task that is intrinsically motivating, that has defined goals and is enjoyable. And that's the like academic, very long, like almost like a run-on sentence in some ways. And the short, more casual way would be that feeling of being in the zone that creates positive emotions.
Yeah.
And a lot of people, and for me too, this topic wasn't something that came up with me. No one showed me this. It was actually, I found it when I was reading from a company that hired me. It was one of the books they gave me here in Atlanta, actually. And I was like, that is that feeling. I've always had it. And it gave me a word, kind of like in emotional intelligence research. If you can start to name the feeling and the emotion that you have, it truly helps your EQ, because you can be more specific than happy, sad, glad kind of thing. You can start to say, well, I'm frustrated, or, you know, let's, you know, broaden that big spectrum of different emotions we're having. It helps you understand better. And so for me, I found that word and I was like, wow, that is exactly what I was feeling.
I like it. So I'm wondering if for people that are making a transition to a new context, and we talked about awareness and being intentional and awareness as they're planning their relation, their asset allocation of relationships, and potentially doing low cost probes on different activities to see if it gives them flow or not.
Right.
But what would you tell them about evaluating activities or evaluating, you know, bringing this idea of flow into the front of their brain so they can say, okay, knowledge, okay, that was really cool. I want to do more of that. This was not really cool. I want to do less of that.
Right.
I mean, how would you coach someone who's saying, okay, I've got, you know, for the first time in my life, I have more time than I've ever had. I've got reasonable financial resources, so I don't have to worry about putting food on the table. How would I go about being conscious or thinking about the things that I want to do and the things I don't want to do? I mean, how would you coach somebody on that? Do you think?
Yeah, and I'll go back to
that. That may not be a fair question, but you've got the PhD, so I can ask it.
And that's a good question. It actually is a good question. And I think I know where you're going. And I'll jump back to the question or the statement you said about, you know, sometimes we go through life unconsciously going through that, like, just living, almost living a life that the world wanted us to live and less of what we wanted to do more purposefully. I believe it was Carl Jung, the psychologist, that said, making the unconscious conscious, and kind of like the little play on the words there. But you're really, I think the best way is you start to reflect on your strengths, but also the things that you do find activities. So like if it is a certain task at work, because a lot of times it might be something at work that you really enjoy doing, but for that second half, you might not need it for the financial reason. So how could you give back? And then you might be hitting other things that add value too. Like, you know, whenever you volunteer and do things like that, it's always like a slap in the face of like, I should do more of this because it gives me so much more context to the world, or gives me such positive to reflect and be like, I've been blessed with so much more. I definitely need to be doing this more. And that's why I mentioned we've actually worked with retiring attorneys who would go and help certain companies or do more pro bono because it became less of a financial thing, or they would go teach. And that's, you know, a lot of times that's what I tell, you know, with that, I actually worked with a pro athlete division. And I would tell some of those people, look, you are a pro athlete. The things you learned in even a short career would change the life of some high school kid that maybe never taught it. I mean, I played at a smaller level college, and just the small things that those coaches taught me they never would teach you in high school or middle school, things that would just change that maybe the trajectory of that person's life. And so for finding flow, I always tell people to reflect on it, find those strengths that you have, and even talk to somebody about it. Because a lot of times we all have gifts that something might come so natural to us, but is really difficult for other people. And that's why I think conversing with someone that you get that impact. And then the last thing I'll mention is one of my favorite things, and I wrote an article about this and happy to share it for like the show notes, but think about the things that made you happy as a child. What were those activities? Because kids definitely get into a flow state because you see when, and I'll use my son as an example, when he's on the playground or he's outside, I mean, he's begging me to go outside, which I'm very grateful for in the world of technology and as a technology person, that he's not wanting to sit in front of his iPad all day. But that happiness on their face. And so if you look back at some of those activities, that might be a starting point to be like, well, maybe I should pick up tennis again, or maybe I should, you know, I used to love being out hiking and doing this thing. Maybe that's something you really want to do. We live in, you know, north of Atlanta. North Georgia has plenty of places to go hiking. So I think you start with one big category. What are things that I enjoy? What are certain strengths that I have? And then you kind of trickle down and you start to evaluate them. Like, you know what? You know, we're all a novice at certain things, but if you always wanted to pursue something, you know what? I always wanted to learn how to ski. Well, maybe you go ski and hopefully you don't, you know, tear an ACL or break a bone. But if you're like, you know what? I just didn't enjoy that. That's fine. Now you've expanded. You maybe met some people in the process. Yeah. But it's also a thing. There's another thing I coach on called anti-flow. It really is valuable to find. It's kind of like anti-goals. Sometimes we don't know what our purpose is or we don't know where we want to go. But if you can find where you don't want to go, you've now actually done just as good of a job because you've shortened that list of things. So,
yeah, I love it. You know, in my book, I did a whole section on, you know, finding, you know, Dan Sullivan calls something similar to this unique ability. It's not exactly the same thing, but I think there's a lot of overlap.
Agree.
But once you find your values, your why, which is the big thing, your values, which I think are obviously critical, and you get clearer and you're more conscious on what gives you flow in your terminology and what doesn't, then you basically create a list of things to say no to, right. Which is kind of the anti flow list. You know, I tried that. I know that's not my thing. I'm not doing that anymore. Right. Because again, we can get guilted into doing things because we think we can should all over ourselves if we're not careful. I should do this. I should do that. I should do this. So that's really helpful in creating, but conscious about what brings me flow, but also conscious on things that either it doesn't or I've tried it and it just wasn't my thing. And so that you don't let the world take over or, you know, guilt take over and drive you on a bus that you're not driving, ride you in a bus that you're not driving.
Yeah. And you've got to give yourself grace too, because it's not going to happen overnight. I mean, for me thinking through those three like things that are almost like a vision statement or my purpose statement to myself and my family, that definitely did not happen. That happened after years of reading psychology, behavioral science, coaching other people, learning their gifts, their blessing, like their path, their purposes, writing a 100+ paper dissertation on a concept. Like there was multiple iterations of that that got declined and told to reiterate. But I think giving yourself some grace on it, that you're not going to find it overnight. And sometimes it'll hit you right in the face. I mean, that there's many times like what had me move to Atlanta was I had a great job where I was at. And I actually was like, I literally in my mind was like, I just want an answer straight to the face on this topic. And I literally met somebody that brought up Atlanta because I had a job offer here. And this was 10+ years ago. But it's crazy how sometimes the things that give you fulfillment, they'll land right in your lap. But sometimes you got to do a little work. But doing the work sometimes helps make it even more purposeful and more engaging and more fun.
Yeah. Well, and have a sense of curiosity. I mean, I've loved your, you know, the curiosity part too, because, you know, I do think the things that we're attracted to come from a higher power, whether you believe in God or something else. I mean, it's not accident. We're all connected. There is a higher power in the universe that has some influence on us. And I think where we're led to is part of that. That sounds a little new agey and weird maybe to some people, but to me, it's pretty clear that there's a divine in all of us. Agreed. And we're getting messages from a divine being. And your curiosity, I think, is a hint about that, what you're supposed to at least start digging under the rocks a little bit to see. I can't get off of a podcast with you without you saying the name of the influencer that got you into flow, because I'll do this by saying if there are resources that the audience wants to learn more about flow, mm-hmm. who are the researchers or the books or the writers that have information that might be interesting?
Yeah, the founder of Flow is actually a Hungarian American and was actually one of what I call the godfathers of positive psychology.
Okay.
He published a paper in 2000, year 2000, okay. Co-authored it with a guy named Marty Seligman, who yep. most people know very well from the PERMA model, which is a very foundational and great piece of research called PERMA, where it talks about just the different each. There's a bit of research for each letter in PERMA, and he was at UPenn, but Mihai Csikszentmihalyi is the Hungarian American that came over during World War II and started researching and found flow, got his PhD from Chicago. And he was very big on wanting to make sure that flow was validated, because a lot of times people hear psychology and they think that it's just so fluff or not replicable. You know, this sounds kind of touchy feely. I don't know if that's a real thing. Well, he coming from one of the most, you know, foundational places where people get their PhD in economics, Mihai wanted to do just rigorous research on it. And he did. And that was actually one of the reasons why I loved flow. And I like to spread spread the gospel of it, is because it's truly ubiquitous across gender, culture, you know, ethnicity, whatever, wherever you live in the world. He studied it and was the shoulders that I stood on to start expanding and extending the research, because he studied it all the way from, you know, Chicago, like assembly line workers, to people in Japan, to Navajo sheep herders. I mean, that's those were all real people that he published papers about.
Yeah.
And I think that that's really interesting, because there's so many things in life that, well, they found this with, you know, this type of people. And it's like, this was found everywhere in the world. And a lot of people use this term flowing, and his purpose statement was what started his research actually in the 60s and 70s. So really where he started to expand was what makes life worth living. And that's what kind of started his research into the world of flow. And he published a book, and he's published quite a few books. He's now deceased, but he published a book in 1990 called Finding Flow. And it's not a really big, like, you know, thick academic literature kind of writing, but there you'll see other ones that pop up that he wrote. But I always recommend Finding Flow because it's shorter, it's more applicable. But if you want to go deeper, he's got, you know, five or six other books. And I'm also happy to share those things. There's a person that if you really want to go deeper, I'll throw this one out there. Of course, I'm happy to have a conversation with any of your listeners, but there's a guy named Arnold Bakker, and that's Bakker. And he is probably one of the biggest researchers of it from the workplace. And that's so great. I use some of his research studying flow at work. And so that's where I've studied specifically on that. But Mihai's final research is probably one of my favorite ones. And that's where he really started to study flow and identity. So for part two of a conversation, that's one thing that we'll have to talk about, because he really started to tie the two together, which was part of my research, and I tried to extend some of that, was with your identity, those self-defining activities are those is where you're going to find flow.
Yeah. Well, you know, as you were talking about his research, I won't try to repronounce his name, but
he went by Dr. Mike to a lot of people.
There you go. And all, yeah, in all these different cultures and backgrounds and all, I remember seeing a famous photographer for National Geographic at a conference many, many years ago, a guy named DeWitt Jones. If you Google him and look at his website, he's a pretty interesting guy. But he had a picture of this lady. I think she was in Ireland or Scotland, and she was weaving. Yeah. And she was just so into her work, and she was just, and she was a master, by the way. She was like well-known in the region as being sort of a master in making these incredible tapestries and stuff. And he took great photos of her, you know, and really captured her. And he asked her, he says, what do you, when you're, you know, when you weave, what do you think about? And her line was, when I weave, you know? So, yeah. I mean, she was just in it. I mean, she was just present in it. She was in the, you know, and it kind of reminded me as you talk about his research to all these different cultures and all these different contexts. Well, before we wrap up, I can't leave with at least asking a little bit about how you're trying to use technology to make these kinds of conversations easier and more relevant for wealth advisors.
Right.
Because I think that's part of what you're doing, I believe.
It is.
So how can technology help with this?
Yeah. And I want to comment on the weaving thing first.
Please.
There's always been such interesting research, and I think this is helpful for like your listeners when they're trying to find those tasks and activities that give this, that some of the foundational research of it was around musicians. So I always talk about, you know, you see a musician and you see someone playing the piano. If you think about jazz music, being in the pocket, like all of these things, like that's a huge, that is flow. Like that, there's not a better way to explain that. Sports teams, when you're like, wow, they're just firing on all cylinders. That team is playing so well together. There's actually a group flow thing. Mm-hmm. And then the last that you mentioned, the weaving, one of the biggest like paramount things that hit me was working with a client at one time, and she was a knitter. So she knitted and how it helped her through a transition in life. So her identity changed. She became a widow. Mm-hmm. And we talked through finding the activities that she hadn't done to help her get through these transitions. And one of them was knitting. And now there is actually academic research out there to show that people find deep flow states in knitting. So I had to mention that so that people kind of see the full spectrum of it. But to go back to your question, it's the way I see technology for, because my client mainly is advisors.
Right.
And when I teach, I'm teaching advisors at Kaplan. And then my job with RFG Advisory is I support 100 plus advisors in 15 states. And the way that I structure technology is I want to structure their day to be able to, what can be the most conducive for a flow state. And so the way that we structure everything in tech there has undertones of behavioral science. So one of the most powerful things in behavioral science is the environment. That's just so much of everything in life. If you can change the environment and even go, let's double click and go down, even the journey you take when you open an app or you open a website, what is that user experience? And so that is what I spend a lot of time. I have a few teams that I work with, is how can we structure an advisor's day so that they can do the things that they are best at and that they find so much purpose in. And the way, what we believe is finding time to spend with clients. Mm-hmm. That's how you learn more about your clients. You're able to build a plan that is more purposeful to them. That's because everyone's different. That's one reason why I don't think AI will steal the advisor's role. At least that's timestamp today. We'll see, 10 years from now, but I don't think so, because it's the same way that TurboTax came out or Quicken or whatever. You can plug everything in, but still to this day, CPAs are jam-packed with work. So I think the same is that if you can create a structure, use AI, use technology so that you can spend more time human to human, that is really where you're going to find flow. And that's where everyone's going to benefit. The client benefits, the advisor finds so much more fulfillment, because that's why they did the job.
Yeah. Very cool. Well, I love it. So this has been fantastic, Jordan. I knew we would enjoy hanging out with you and hearing, at least I will. I'm sure the audience will as well. So how can the audience find out more about you and the work that you're doing if they want to reach out to you or at least find you on social platforms or wherever they can find you? What's the easiest way for them to look up Jordan?
Yeah. So the easiest way to find me is LinkedIn, Dr. Jordan Hutchison. I think there's only a couple of us out there, which is kind of interesting with technology these days. You could see if people have the exact same name. And then also, if you're an Instagram person, I have Dr. Jordan Hutchison as well. You can find me on both of those. I'm pretty easy to find.
Awesome. Well, thanks so much, Jordan. This has been fantastic. Really enjoyed hanging out with you, as always. And all you guys, I hope you enjoyed the conversation today with Jordan. Please leave comments or reviews of the show on your streaming platform of choice, iTunes, Spotify. You can also reach out to me by email at moneyandmeaning@tandemgrowth.com. As you know, you can find my book, The Money and Meaning Journey, on all the online retailers, as well as jeffbernierauthor.com. So again, thank you for being with us today. And as is my normal encouragement, go find what makes your heart come alive and put the plans in place to pursue it. Take care, all. See you around.
Thank you for listening to the Money and Meaning Show with Jeff Bernier, a show dedicated to help you gain the confidence and freedom to lead a life of personal significance and help you get your actions and resources in alignment with what matters most. We would love to hear from you. If you have any questions for Jeff or comments on the show, feel free to reach out to us at moneyandmeaning@tandemgrowth.com. Or you can find us on the web at www.tandemgrowth.com. Jeff Bernier is the President and Chief Investment Officer at Tandem Growth Financial Advisors, LLC, an SEC registered investment advisor. This show is a production of Tandem Growth Financial Advisors, LLC. All information discussed is general in nature, is provided for informational purposes only, and should not be construed as specific financial, legal, or tax advice. Listeners should consult an attorney or tax professional regarding their specific legal or tax situation. Listeners should not rely on the content of this podcast as the basis for any investment decisions. A professional advisor should be consulted, and/or independent due diligence should be conducted before implementing anything discussed in this show. While information presented is believed to be factual and up-to-date, Tandem Growth Financial Advisors, LLC, does not guarantee its accuracy, and it should not be regarded as a complete analysis of the subjects discussed. Tandem Growth Financial Advisors, LLC, does not make any representations or warranties as to the accuracy, timeliness, suitability, completeness, or relevance of any information prepared by any unaffiliated third party, such as guests on the podcast, and takes no responsibility for the same.